This is Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue and Camille Koppenberg. KGMI and the Cascade Radio Group receive financial compensation to present this program in its entirety.
The opinions voiced on Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue and Camille Koppenberg are for general information only and not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine what is appropriate for you, consult a qualified professional. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, a registered investment advisor. Carson Partners is a division of CWM LLC, a nationwide partnership of advisors. Guests on Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue and Camille Koppenberg are not affiliated with CWM LLC.
Welcome to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning here on KGMI. Housing boom is to continue. Housing prices have soared in the past year. The National Case-Shiller Index is up 11.2% in the past 12 months, the largest gain since 2005 and 6. The FHFA index is up 12% in the past 12 months, the largest on record going back to 1991. Given these gains, some are wondering whether housing is back in the 2000s type bubble, but a deep dive into the data suggests that we are not. To assess home prices, we use the market value of all owner-occupied homes, calculated by the Federal Reserve. We then compare that to the imputed rent calculated by the Commerce Department for the GDP report. Imputed rents means what people pay to rent their homes if they rented them from someone else. In the last 40 years, home values have typically been 16.4 times annual rent. At the peak of the bubble in 2005, they were 21.4 times annual rent, or 33% above. Now, home prices are 17.8 times annual rent, about 11% above normal. We also compare home prices to the Fed's measure of replacement cost. In the last 40 years, home prices have typically been 1.59 times replacement cost. In 2005, they peaked at 1.94 times replacement cost, a premium of 22.5%. Now homes are selling for 1.63 times replacement cost, only 2.5 times above normal, which is minimal. Does this mean housing is at risk? We don't think so. The recent price surge is based on fundamentals, and the housing market should continue to boom. The primary problem is a lack of homes. Based on population growth and scrappage, voluntary knockdowns, fires, floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, etc., we would normally expect housing starts at 1.5 million per year. But in the past 20 years, March of 2001 through February of this year, builders have only started 1.256 million per year. Builders haven't started more than 1.5 million homes in a calendar year since 2006. No wonder the inventory of homes for sale is so low. Single-family existing home inventories are at rock-bottom levels, with only 870,000 for sale in February. To put this in perspective, the lowest inventory for any February on record from 1982 through 2016 was 1.55 million. Meanwhile, there are only 40,000 completed new homes for sale versus 77,000 a year ago, and an average of 87,000 in the last 20 years. Two other factors are likely at work. One issue is that there's a moratorium on evictions, so some tenants are paying less in rent than they normally would, which is temporarily holding down rental values versus home prices, therefore elevating the price-to-rent ratio. This is also holding down the housing component of the Consumer Price Index, which is calculated using rents, not home prices. Another factor is that people have moved away from places where renting is popular to places where homeownership is popular. If you leave New York City or San Francisco for Nashville or Boise, there's a good chance that you went from renting to owning. That helps boost home prices as well. And yes, home prices are up. And yes, they look somewhat expensive relative to normal, but this is more about the unprecedented events of the past decade, not some problem with the market. With the Fed so easy and the stock of housing constrained, prices will continue to rise. The housing boom will continue. Let's look at this week's global roundup. We're going to find that equities have continued to advance as the U.S. economy bounces back. So global equities were trading in record territory as the U.S. economy continued signs of recovery and earnings reports largely beat expectations. Despite very strong data this week, the yields on the benchmark U.S. 10-year Treasury note declined 13 basis points to 1.57% amid reports of renewed overseas buying, particularly from Asia. The price of a barrel of West Texas Intermediate crude oil rallied from about $4 to $63.35 from a week ago, while volatility as measured by the CBOE Volatility Index, or VIX, held steady at 16.5. And the U.S. economy is shifting into higher gear. After being disrupted by rough winter weather in February, economic activity in the United States gathered pace in March as retail sales surged 9.8%. Weekly jobless claims fell below 600,000 for the first time since the onset of the pandemic, and regional U.S. Federal Reserve surveys from New York and Philadelphia showed strong upticks. Inflation ticked higher in March, too, with the consumer price index rising 2.6% at the headline level and 1.6% stripping out food and energy. Bottlenecks in the production cycle continue, while comparisons with very weak a year ago data will feed through to the inflation readings in the coming months. The Fed has said it will look through these so-called base effects, and U.S. regulators are cooling the SPAC, or SPAC as we know it, which is Special Purpose Acquisition Companies, but frenzy. Growing regulatory scrutiny on Special Purpose Acquisition Companies, or SPACs, has resulted in a sharp slowdown in the registration of these vehicles in recent weeks. Month to date, only 12 new SPACs have been filed to go public, down from an average of 4 to 5 a day in the first quarter. Regulators have begun focusing on optimistic revenue projections used by startups acquired by SPACs. This week, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission said it may also require that warrants issued to early investors be classified as liabilities rather than equity, forcing SPACs to restate their financial results. Also this week, the U.S. Senate confirmed Washington and Wall Street veteran Gary Gensler as SEC chair. And Europe is struggling amid surge in COVID-19 cases. In Europe, the World Health Organization projects that nearly 9,600 people an hour are testing positive for COVID-19, and estimates that over 1 million Europeans have succumbed to the virus so far. While the region's vaccine rollout has been problematic, the pace of the vaccinations has improved in many countries. With hospitals close to capacity in many countries, lockdowns remain widespread. As a result, economic growth is expected to rebound more slowly in Europe than in the United States. Investors are bullied up. Several measures of investor sentiment are flashing warnings of irrational exuberance as equity markets extend their rallies. The latest Bank of America Global Fund Manager survey shows that equity allocations have reached a 10-year high. The survey has also showcased a potential taper tantrum as the single largest risk facing investors in the months ahead. Also near a cycle peak is the bullish reading from Investors Intelligence at 63.4%. And China reports that eye-opening first quarter growth domestic product in China grew 18.3% in the first quarter of 21, compared with the same quarter a year ago when the country was in the throes of coronavirus lockdown. While the numbers appear robust on the surface, analysts expect that China's fastest period of recovery is behind it, and that growth will quickly moderate toward a 6% annual rate in the quarters ahead. Economists also note that seasonal adjustments data has been thrown out of whack by coronavirus restrictions, which limited the traditional movement of migrant workers to their hometowns over the Lunar New Year period, while keeping historically shuttered factories in operation over the holiday. Dick Donahue with Wealth Wake Up. We'll be right back.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life. And I had to start again with just my children and my wife.
Welcome to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning here on KGMI. We are Asset Advisors, located out on I-5 on the Pacific Highway on your way to Ferndale next to Wilson's Furniture in the Pacific Commerce Center. Our address is 5060 Pacific Highway, Suite 101, Ferndale, 98248. Our phone number is 360-733-1200. And check out our website at assetadvisorsllc.net. And a little programming note, we will be doing a Zoom conference call this Thursday at 1 o'clock, be headed by Scott Cuby, who's head of research for the Carson Group, and he will be doing a review of this last market quarter and looking ahead with a quarterly market update for what we expect in the quarter ahead of us. Anyway, if you want to sign up for that Zoom call, give Camille a call, 360-733-1200, and have her schedule it. She'll send you the links and show you how you can sign in on that. Let's talk about a few quick hits this week. The International Monetary Fund this week urged officials in the Eurozone to increase government spending by an additional 3% of GDP to mitigate the economic impact of the pandemic. And according to a CNBC poll, U.S. President Joe Biden's proposed infrastructure program is proving much less popular with the public than the previously passed coronavirus recovery plan. 36% support infrastructure spending, while 33% oppose it. In contrast, that's about twice as many that favored the recently passed American recovery plan than oppose it. And the European new car registration surged 63% in March compared with the year-ago levels. This came during the early days of the pandemic. Italy forecasts that its debt-GDP ratio will hit an all-time high of near 160% this year, and that growth will rebound less strongly than previously forecast at about 4.5% in 2021. The country's deficit will tally around 11.8% of GDP, the government projects. And Europe's Stock 600 index joined the S&P 500 index in record territory late this week. Then this week, European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde said that the Eurozone economy will need both monetary and fiscal support well into the recovery. And Reuters reports that the Chinese regulators have asked banks not to withhold loans to embattled asset management firm China Harong Asset Management Company as part of support measures to stabilize its cash flow and reduce the risk of market contagion. The manager of distressed assets has withdrawn scrutiny in recent weeks from credit rating agencies and has delayed releasing earnings. China's Ministry of Finance is the firm's largest shareholder. And the British economy expanded at 0.4% in February after contracting in January. The economy remained 7.8% smaller than it was before the pandemic hit in February of 2020. And the U.S. announced it will withdraw all military forces from Afghanistan by the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And looking at earnings news, with about 9% of the constituents of the S&P 500 index having reported for the first quarter of 21, blended earnings per share, which combines reported data and estimates for those that have yet to report, shows that earnings growth is running at 30.1%, while sales rose 6.8% compared with the same quarter a year ago, when the effects of the pandemic were first being felt. According to data from FactSet Research, about 81% of the companies are beating analysts' estimates so far this quarter. Let's talk about that Consumer Price Index report that came out this week. And what do you get when you take rising vaccinations and immunity, add in additional stimulus, all in an economy where supply chains are working to get back online? Inflation, rising at the fastest pace in more than a decade on the tails of sizable increases in January and February. The 0.6% increase in the March CPI ties for the largest single month increase going back to 2009. The monthly gain in March, as well as the base effect impact of comparing to last March when prices were declining, pushed the 12-month increase of the CPI up to 2.6%. While the largest monthly decline coming last April, even a flat reading in the CPI in the month ahead would put the 12-month CPI rise increase above 3%. It's going to take time for supply chain issues that have been created shortages and lifted prices for things like semiconductors, lumber, household appliances to resolve, but that is temporary, or, as the Fed likes to say, transitory factor. What is less temporary is the massive 27% increase in the M2 money supply and ongoing proposals for trillions more in government spending. Simply put, math wins. And today, the math says inflation above the Fed's 2% target is likely to be with us for some time. Will that change the Fed's plans to hold rates at zero for the foreseeable future? Don't count on it. The Fed seems to believe that this rise will ease later this year and into next year as reopenings help ease supply chain pressures. We believe they are writing off the upward pressure in prices from the money supply and growth too quickly. Taking a look at the details of the report shows energy-led consumer price index higher in March, rising 5% on the back of higher costs for gasoline and natural gas. Food prices rose as a more modest 0.1% as higher costs for fruits and vegetables were largely offset by lower prices on dairy products. If you strip out these typically volatile categories and core prices still rose 0.3% in March, here housing costs were the main contributor, despite the government's measure for housing, which focuses on what homeowners would have to pay if they rented the house from someone else, being artificially subdued by the moratorium on evictions. We like to follow cash inflation, which is everything in the CPI except for owners' equivalent rent. Cash inflation increased 0.7% in March and is up 4.9% annual rate since prices began to rise again last June. Prices for used cars, impacted by the semiconductor shortage, slowing productions of today's even more tech-heavy vehicles, auto insurance, medical care also moved higher. Inflation will be the front and center in 2021 as the Fed and the markets try to untangle just how quickly and how sustained will be the impact of the unprecedented spending in response to COVID-19. There is no free lunch. And March's housing restarts. The housing construction came roaring back in March following the large but temporary disruption from February's severe winter weather. The 19.4% gain in housing starts puts them in the highest level since 2006, and the gains were broad-based in every region outside the West, and both single-family and multifamily construction posting increases. Not every month is going to be this strong, but we expect housing starts to remain in an upward trend. Why the confidence? Building permits for future construction remain at the highest level since 2006. Moreover, permits have now outpaced new construction for 8 consecutive months. This has resulted in a backlog of projects that have been authorized but yet not yet started, which is now the largest in nearly 15 years. There has been a long-running deficit in new home construction. The U.S. needs roughly 1.5 million home starts a year, based on population growth and scrappage, which is voluntary knockdowns, natural disasters, etc. But we haven't built that many new homes on any calendar year since 2006. Now, with plenty of future building activity in the pipeline, builders looking to boost inventory of homes as well as meet consumer demand, it looks likely that construction in 2021 will surpass the 1.5 million unit benchmark. This positive outlook is reinforced by the read on the NAHB index, a gauge of home builder sentiment, which rose to a reading of 83 in April from 82 in March. The gain was driven by strong consumer demand for homes, offsetting rising material costs, especially lumber, another signal of ongoing inflation pressure as the U.S. begins to reopen. Dick Donahue with you. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning. Again, if you got questions for us, give us a call, 360-733-1200. Let's talk about March's retail sales report that also came out this week. And retail sales soared in March as Washington, D.C. was passing out checks like it's going out of style. Retail sales skyrocketed 9.8% for the month, crushing the consensus expectations of 5.8% gain, and the underlying details of the report were strong as well. All 13 major categories rose in March, with autos leading the way. The massive gain in sales was a result of several factors, including a rebound from the polar vortex that hit much of the midsection of the United States in February, tax refunds that went out a little later than normal, $1,400 stimulus checks that arrived in March for many, plus the additional easing of lockdown restrictions nationwide. Notably, the level of retail sales in March was 17.1% higher than it was in February 2020 before COVID. In other words, retail sales in March were not just V-shaped, it bounced back, but like a check mark from prior weaknesses up to a level that probably would not have been reached in the absence of COVID. Now, as the vaccine continues to roll out around the country, lockdowns and restrictions will continue to ease. More than 250 million vaccine doses have been distributed nationwide, with about 195 million administered. It has not been an even recovery for all major categories, though. For instance, sporting goods stores were up 43.9%, non-store retailers up 35%, building materials up 29.3%. Auto sales up 26.8%, all have grown significantly faster than overall retail sales since February of 2020. Although growing slower than overall sales among those sectors that were massively impacted by the shutdowns early, our only restaurants and bars are down 4.8%, remain below February's 2020 levels. Gas stations up 12.6%, clothing stores up 3.3%, have now recovered to their pre-COVID levels. Core sales, which excludes the most volatile categories of autos, building materials, and gas stations, rose 7.8% in March and are up 17% from a year ago. Initial jobless claims fell 193,000 last week to 576,000, while continuing claims rose 4,000 to 3,731,000. In other news, on the inflation front, import prices jumped 1.2% in March, largely the result of a 6.3% surge in fuel prices. Meanwhile, export prices increased 2.1% as agricultural export prices jumped 2.4%. In the last year, import prices are up 6.9%, while export prices are up 9.1%. Jumps like these indicate the rising inflation trend we are likely to witness in the year ahead. In March's industrial production capacity report and utilization that came out, industrial production began to rebound from the plunge in activity related to severe winter weather in February. But while good news, don't get too excited about the report. Yes, both industrial production and manufacturing activity are now up from a year ago, but this is just the result of the big declines we saw last year in the early days of the pandemic, rolling into the year-ago comparison. Looking at the overall progress of the recovery versus pre-pandemic levels shows a different story. Manufacturing production is not only still down 2% from February of 2020, but is down 1.1% from January 2021 levels before the winter storm hit in February as well. That means there continues to be a wide gulf between the production and consumption sides of the U.S. economy, which creates conditions for rising inflation. For example, consumer spending data shows retail sales, excluding the widely shut down restaurant sector, are now up 20.2% from pre-pandemic levels. COVID has nearly shifted consumer preferences from services like travel, dining, and attending sporting events towards goods, and that means a continued rebound in industrial production will be necessary to meet demand going forward. While nearly every major category posted gains in March, the one source of weakness came from utilities, where activity fell 11.4%. However, this is just the result of a decline in demand in home heating as the unseasonably cold weather in February became unseasonably warm weather in March. Look for a continued upward spread in the industrial production in the months ahead as reopening continues and factories continue to ramp up production. measures of factory-related sentiment, reinforces this outlook. The Empire State Index, a measure of New York's factory sentiment, rose to plus 26.3 in April from plus 17.4 in March, the highest reading since 2017. Meanwhile, the Philadelphia Fed Index surged to its highest level since 1973, posting a reading of 50.2 in April versus a already sky-high reading of 44.5 in March. Okay, well, you're aware, we cover a lot of information here on IRAs. Being part of the Ed Slott IRA group, Master Elite IRA group, you can go to their website at irahelp.com. But a very important notice just came out this week, so pay attention, because we've talked a lot about the SECURE Act, and the then 10-year RMD rule is not what we thought it was. And the reason we say that is because in March of this year, IRS released IRS Publication 590B, which contains tax rules on withdrawing funds from individual retirement accounts. Normally, this is a wrap-up of the rules to use as guidance in preparing tax returns, but not this time. In the new 2021 version updated on March 25th, the IRS included explaining how the SECURE Act rules would work for post-death distributions to IRA beneficiaries, and the rules are not what anyone thought they would be. The 10-year rule, which was one of the big changes of the SECURE Act, was the elimination of what we called the stretch IRA for most non-spouse beneficiaries. It was replaced by what we call the 10-year rule, which says the inherited IRA or Roth IRA funds must be withdrawn by the end of the 10th year period after the death of the IRA owner. This 10-year rule requires a non-spouse designated beneficiary, which is individuals like children and grandchildren who have been named to the IRA beneficiary form. Eligible designated beneficiaries, or EDBs, are exempt and can still use the stretch IRA. This group includes the spouse, certain minor children of the deceased spouse, and owner or plan participant, and the disabled and chronically ill, and beneficiaries who are not more than 10 years younger than the deceased IRA owner. These SECURE Act rules have been effective since the beginning of 2020. So we've had some who have already died, and their beneficiaries are now subject to these rules. Virtually all commentators, including us and all the information that we've had, thought that the 10-year rule meant that the inherited amount would have to be emptied by the end of the 10-year period after death, but that no distributions would be required in years 1 to 9, which is the way the 5-year rule works. The 5-year rule is used under a different scenario, but there is no designated beneficiary and the IRA owner dies before his required beginning date for required RMDs at age 72. There would be one required minimum distribution, and that was the balance of the account, and that would have been at the end of 10 years. So backing up to what we're saying here is all the readings on the new rules when the SECURE Act was passed said that you essentially, even though you couldn't stretch it out over the lifetime of some beneficiaries, that they could leave that money sit there and grow tax-free for 10 years. That now is not the case. They have to take and follow the RMD rules and start taking money out over those 10 years. And at the end of the 10th year, they have to take out the bailing. So, you know, this would provide some planning flexibility in years 1 to 9, allowing distributions to be adjusted to tax brackets in those years. This is also a benefit of inherited Roth IRAs, where nothing would have been had to be withdrawn from the inherited Roth until the end of the 10th year following death, following 10 years of tax-free buildup before the Roth funds would have to be withdrawn. Okay, Roths are the same way. They now cannot leave that money sit there for the full 10 years. But in the shocker, the IRS publication 590B that came out says otherwise. Pages 11 and 12 provide an explanation and an example showing that beneficiaries would be subject to RMDs each year under the SECURE Act rules for years 1 through 9, and then the balance must be withdrawn in year 10. No one saw this coming. This doesn't go along with the SECURE Act rules and committee reports, which seem to indicate that the new 10-year rule would work like the old SECURE Act 5-year rule, with no annual distributions required. So this unexpected interpretation would be a more of a nuisance than a tax problem, since most RMDs in the first years, in this case 1 through 9, are still smaller. It's more of an administrative and complexity problem. So again, got questions about these type of things? Don't be afraid to give us a call. Dick Donahue will be right back with Wealth Wake Up.
'Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you here on KGMI this Sunday morning. Well, we just talked about a surprise that we just received notice on this week, and that was a new interpretation under the SECURE Act that you can't sit there and wait for 10 years before you take out your RMDs out of your IRAs following death. The beneficiary now has to take it out over the 9 years using the RMD payables. Now, that does not apply to a spouse, but anybody but non-spouse, and there's a couple of other exceptions. I'm not going to repeat that information, but we also had another one jump out us this week, and basically Medicare is not going to alert you about your Part B eligibility. And so in one of its last moves of 2020, the U.S. Congress punted on a terrific opportunity to help people navigate Medicare's enrollment. There's a little notice section of the $2.3 trillion COVID bill and spending bill that passed in December that would have required the Social Security Administration to alert people under the new law that coverage will begin a month after enrollment starting in 2023. And that's extremely important. But left on the cutting room floor, the provision that beefed up enrollment notification requirements was left out of the final legislation for reasons that have not yet been explained, and I find credible, basically, but that exclusion is very unfortunate. So let's look and review the basics. If you're already receiving Social Security benefits at age 65, Medicare enrollment is automatic, but for everyone else, it is a proactive process. So along with the aforementioned coverage gaps, failure to enroll at age 65 can saddle you with stiff late enrollment surcharges. These are equal to 10% of the standard Part B premium for every 12 months of delay, a penalty that continues for the rest of your life. The penalties can really add up over the years as base premiums rise. For married couples, the penalties can effectively double if both spouses fail to enroll on time. And Medicare's prescription drug program, Part D, comes with a much less onerous late enrollment penalty, equal to 1% of the national base beneficiary premium for each month of delay. So you need to enroll during the initial enrollment period in order to avoid the late penalties, with one major exception. If you're still actively employed and covered by employer insurance, later on, when active employment stops, there's a special enrollment period that allows delayed enrollment without incurring the late penalties. A spouse who's covered under a worker's policy can also do the same. However, for anyone working for a firm with 20 or fewer employees, Medicare becomes the primary payer. In those cases, enrollment must occur at the first period nearing age 65 of their eligibility to enroll in Medicare, and the potential stiff costs and other risks if they fail to do so. In typical fashion, this legislation was a Christmas tree with many ornaments hung. One of the best ornaments was key provisions of the Bennies Act, is a bill that Medicare advocates have been pushing for several years. The important changes that were approved will shorten long waiting lines for coverage to begin and streamline other outdated features of the Medicare enrollment. But unfortunately, one part of the Bennies Act that was left out of the final legislation would have required the Social Security Administration to inform people as they got near age 65 that they're eligible to enroll in Medicare Part B and to explain the consequences of mistakenly delayed enrollment. So let's talk about streamlined enrollments available. Currently, Medicare has 3 enrollment periods. The initial enrollment period, which includes 3 months before you turn 65, a month of your 65th birthday, and the 3 months after you turn 65 to become eligible for Medicare due to receiving Social Security disability benefits. Coverage begins in 1 to 3 months later, depending on when you enroll. For people transitioning from employer coverage at a later age, a special enrollment period is available for 8 months after the insurance ends. Coverage begins the first month after enrollment. But if you miss either of these enrollments, you must wait for general enrollment period that runs from January 1st to March 31st each year. Medicare coverage under Part B, and in some cases Part A, does not begin until July 1st. The New York Times recently featured the story of a man who's mistakenly terminated his Obamacare plan just ahead of his Medicare enrollment and was hit with a $22,367 bill for a suspended COVID-19 hospitalization. So eligibility gaps, you must make sure that you're covered so you avoid those out-of-pocket costs. And there are other complications. Let's say you have lost your job at, say, 64, and you're covered under COBRA. You know, you can keep that policy and delay Medicare enrollment. Well, yes, you might want to keep COBRA if, let's say, you're using it to cover your family members. But if you also must enroll in Medicare if you wish to avoid the late penalties because there is no longer actively employed in the insurance plan sponsor. What we're saying, you're covered under COBRA, get enrolled. You can wait and keep your the rest of your family under COBRA. Okay, let's say that you enrolled in a policy through the Affordable Care Act. You still need to move to Medicare at age 65. And then it's bad enough that Social Security no longer mails out their annual statements to all its workers. The mailings have been cut back over the years to save money, printing, and postage. Currently, the only people receiving paper statements by mail are those over the age of 60 who have not claimed benefits and do not have an online account. Until about a decade ago, all workers eligible for Social Security received a paper statement in the mail that provided useful projections of their benefits at various ages, along with reminders of the availability of disability benefits and at least some Medicare enrollment information. For most, the only way to access this statement is by signing up for the online account at Social Security website. This is well worth doing as part of a broader agency strategy to handle more business in the public online. But that begs the question as to why the Final Beneficiary Act language didn't require beefed up Medicare language. It would have been inexpensive to do so, and it could have benefited many workers. Advocates say that they'll try again on the Medicare guidance in future legislation, but no matter what happens, the episode serves as a reminder of the critical importance of paying attention to Medicare enrollment as you receive or get near age 65. I think most of you know this, but I'm a capitalist, Mr. President. Mr. Biden, you are not. Back in the day when Saturday Night Live was funny, Chevy Chase would open the weekend update segment by saying, "I'm Chevy Chase and you're not." That line came to mind over President Joe Biden's massive tax and spend proposals, which are unlike anything since FDR, with whom Biden appears to be modeling himself. The president thinks he's a capitalist, and he's not. In very short time, we have regressed from Ronald Reagan's government is not the solution to our problem. Government is our problem, and Bill Clinton's declaration that the era of big government is over to Biden's belief that the era of big government is just beginning. Let's define two terms. First, capitalism, and it's an economic system in which investment in and ownership of the means of production, distribution, and exchange of wealth is made and maintained chiefly by private individuals or corporations, especially as contrasted to cooperatively or state-owned means of wealth. Now, socialism. It's a theory or system of social organization that advocates the ownership and control of the means of production and distribution, capital, land, etc., but the community as a whole, usually through a centralized government. The definition of which fits Biden's tax and spending blowout is the latter, socialism. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is ratcheting up the notion that only government is the answer to every problem by proposing a global minimum tax. Axios reports that, which now includes the rationale behind her thinking. Convincing other countries to impose a global minimum tax would reduce the likelihood of companies relocating offshore as Biden seeks to increase the corporate rate from 21% to 28%. But that's backwards. But it also typifies the thinking of those whose faith is ever growing more expensive and with massive government. Former President Donald Trump, reduction in corporate tax rates persuaded some businesses to move back to the U.S. from overseas. They had exited because of higher rates. Mark Zandi, chief economist for Moody's Analytics, reacted to the Biden administration's tax and spend proposals, said when he told The Hill, it takes a whole different perspective on government. Ever since Ronald Reagan, it's been about government dysfunction. We need smaller government, less government. This is the completely opposite. It says the government and only the government can solve problems that are having because they're so large and beyond any one of us. Infrastructure is a collective problem. The obvious question then becomes, if big government can solve our problems, why hasn't it solved them by now? In 2018, Investor's Business Daily quoted a Bureau of Economic Analysis some $305.6 billion returned to the U.S. from overseas accounts after President Trump cut corporate tax rates. That's at a 1.2%, a $2 trillion annual rate, and far above the $35 billion 1 year before that. How is returning to the bad, good old days of higher taxes going to convince these companies that return home to stay home? No reporter has asked the question, and no one in the Biden administration has voluntarily offered an explanation. Speaking of Chevy Chase, the comedian once said, socialism works, and Cuba might prove it. I think it's conclusive that there have been areas where socialism has helped to keep people at least stabilized at a certain level. Yes, and that level is mutually shared meritocracy, in some cases mutually shared poverty. Capitalism raises boats for all those who play by its rules, accompanied by a shared moral values, while socialism, especially when paired with communism, sinks too many boats and too many hopes. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI. Thanks for being with us. Have a great week. Give us a call if you got questions, 360-733-1200. If you like to get information on Thursday on that quarterly market update with Scott Cuby, call Camille. She'll get you scheduled.